Good morning. My name is Jason Dunn. I'm here on behalf of Oasis Legal Finance and Plaintiff Funding Holding. With me today are representatives of the company, as well as my co-counsel, Carl Schock. The question before the court in this case is whether the definition of loan under the Uniform Consumer Credit Code includes an agreement for the purchase and sale of a speculative, illiquid interest, asset, where the parties agree that the seller shall have no obligation to repay the purchase price should the buyer's investment turn out to be worthless or less than the buyer anticipated. The Supreme Court's opinion in the Cash Now case is dispositive, and the answer to that question is no. Rather, Cash Now stands for the proposition that non-recourse transactions are not loans. Cash Now was primarily a case about whether this court had defined the term loan under the UCCC too narrowly, as limited to only cases where the seller has an unconditional obligation of repayment.
Mr. Dunn, before you get too far down the line, maybe you can help me out with some definitions. I know you've talked extensively in your brief about recourse and non-recourse. You never defined the term. And I'm curious, I guess I'll just ask you two questions while I have interrupted you. You seem to agree that debt includes contingent debt. It's not clear to me why this is not a contingent debt. You get paid if they recover. Second, would you define what you mean by non-recourse or recourse, and explain to me why there's no recourse here? You can sue them if they don't pay you. So those two questions.
Sure. I would not agree that contingent debt is debt. The facts in this case...
I thought you said that in your brief, if I'm not mistaken. I thought you gave us that definition.
No, that I believe that the administrator has a section, or perhaps it's the amicus brief, that talks about contingent debt being a form of debt. What our position is that the Cash Now held that a contingent obligation can be a loan, and we don't dispute the holding of Cash Now in that context. In this case, the purchaser is purchasing an asset, an illiquid, as I said, speculative asset of the seller. If the transaction, if the underlying litigation fails, if the plaintiff in the underlying litigation decides to drop their case, then the purchaser of that asset has no recourse against the seller. It cannot go back to the seller and say, oh, well, the litigation failed or it didn't result in enough of a settlement, therefore you are obligated to pay me that amount.
So why is that not a contingent obligation?
I think Cash Now answered that question. In Cash Now, the court had a choice. It could have said that a situation, remember in that case that was a tax refund, purchase of anticipated tax refund. And the court said, okay, there's a obligation that when the tax refund is paid, you owe that to us. Likewise, in that case, the seller had the obligation, the contingent obligation, that if the tax refund doesn't amount to the amount that was anticipated, they have to pay that. So there was a contingency, to use your language, either way. But what the court said is they didn't deem that an absolute obligation. They deemed that a contingent obligation that the seller possessed. Here we don't have that obligation, so this must be something less than Cash Now.
And I'm sorry to keep interrupting, Mr. Dunn, I'm just not sure I'm understanding. And maybe you're drawing your attention to a potential inconsistency in Cash Now. Cash Now reversed the Court of Appeals decision that said you have to have an unconditional obligation to pay. Says you don't have to have that to be a loan. I mean, it does make a statement later in the opinion that this is debt because essentially the lender there gets paid either way. And so maybe that's your argument is on the second piece, but I'm not quite sure how we square that with the first piece without saying the Supreme Court was inconsistent. It seems to me that you're arguing to us that there has to be an unconditional obligation to pay, which seems to be your definition of recourse.
The obligation that the seller owes in the Cash Now case was obviously an obligation that was contingent upon the tax refund not occurring as anticipated. Here, the seller has no such obligation. The purchaser has purchased an asset. It is their piece of the litigation. In fact, in some cases, in many cases, their piece of the litigation proceeds is paid directly to them. In some cases, it goes to the lawyer, who then has a ministerial role to convey that asset to the purchaser. But in no event is it the seller's asset that then they have a contingent obligation to comply. I guess it's the difference between A contingency, meaning the contingency of whether or not the underlying litigation is successful, and a contingency that triggers the seller's separate obligation to pay from their personal assets.
So, go ahead, Jerry.
Counsel, if I may interrupt, it appears to me that you're focusing only on one possible outcome, and there are many possible outcomes in this scenario. If the plaintiff in the lawsuit recovers, there must be repayment. If the plaintiff in the lawsuit decides to try to back out of the contract in any way, there's got to be repayment. So you only talk about one fact, and this contract actually applies to a whole bunch of different facts. So why don't you address that in the context of whether this is contingent or not? Because in those situations, there's an absolute obligation for the plaintiff in the lawsuit to repay.
If I understand your question, Judge, the contracts include provisions, like any other purchase and sale agreement, that give the parties an opportunity to enforce the agreement as written. If the seller in one of these contracts just decides that they're going to go ahead and take the litigation proceeds for themselves, the purchaser has a right to enforce the agreement that that's their asset and it should be conveyed to them. A right to enforce the contract, another example, if the lawyer absconds or if the defendant doesn't pay. In the latter case, of course, if the defendant doesn't pay despite the fact that they lose, the purchaser has no right to go after the seller for repayment. But in terms of the contractual provisions, the obligation to fulfill the terms of the contract, sure, the purchaser has recourse. They can go to court and say, you didn't uphold your end of the bargain. That's different than saying the purchaser has recourse under the purchase and sale agreement to go after the seller for the return on their investment they had hoped to achieve from the underlying litigation.
So your argument, I think, Mr. Dunn, correct me if I'm wrong, that this is non-recourse because there is a scenario where the buyers, your clients, would not get their money back.
Not exactly, Your Honor. Non-recourse means that they have no right to go after the seller for any return on their investment or the principal on their investment.
If the seller didn't recover enough, because they clearly have a right to do that if the seller recovered enough.
That's true. But remember, when you say the seller recovered enough, that implies the seller, that the proceeds from the litigation are the seller's to begin with. They're not. The purchaser purchases a piece of that asset. Again, it's illiquid and speculative and has a degree of risk, but it is a purchase, no different than purchasing accounts receivable from a company where you purchase it at a discount and hope that you can recover. If those accounts receivables are paid to the original holder of that debt, sure, the purchaser of that has the right to go after to recover that, but that doesn't mean that they have recourse against the seller of that account receivable in a situation where they're just simply unable to recover on the debt.
If I purchase an account receivable, do I have to pay monthly interest in the course of that purchase?
It's not, as I understand those transactions, they're not defined as monthly interest. But one of the interesting things I think in relevant here in those type of cases, and I think that industry is called factoring for a reason I'm not quite sure of, but when you purchase at a discount, there's actually a time component similar to what's involved here in my client's contracts. So, for example, a purchaser of accounts receivable might say, I will purchase from you your accounts receivable at 60 cents on the dollar. But then there'll be an additional time component. So if I am able to recover that within 30 days, I'll give you another 10%. If it takes me 60 days, I give you less or whatever, something like that. So it adds in a time component, but no, it's not an interest component.
So let me follow up then on Judge Bernard's question. Is there a transaction where you buy some accounts receivable and pay more money while you're waiting? I mean, you can call it what you want. I mean, I understand you don't want to call it interest for a reason. I get it. But it certainly feels like that. I mean, usually when you buy something, you buy it, you own it, end of story. But here, you bought this chosen action or receivable, whatever you want to call it, but the other side has to pay you until an additional amount of money, depending on how long it takes for them to give you the money back. Why isn't that a loan, as opposed to a purchase of receivable? Because I can't conceive of a place where you buy a chosen action, you buy some widget, and have to pay more money until you get it.
Well, I think the accounts receivable is probably the best example where I think the amount changes over time. But I think there's no reason that, well, I'll give you another example. When a private equity investment, when someone puts money into a startup company, as I understand the venture capital world, they are looking for a rate of return on their investment depending on when that company either is sold or goes public. And they have a time horizon that, as time goes on, diminishes their rate of return, their interest on their investment in that company. It may not be a prescribed amount, and in some cases maybe it is, but it certainly is not interest and certainly not deemed a loan.
But they may lose all of it. I mean, there's no
And that's exactly the scenario here. Purchasers here, in some cases, do lose their investment. They transfer money. The next day, that seller can say, I'm dropping my case, tricked you. They can walk away from their case the next day, and the purchaser has no recourse other than perhaps maybe a fraud or a good faith argument under the terms of the contract.
But the purchaser purchases a portion of the potential recovery, and that portion changes over time. Why doesn't that look like interest?
It may look like interest in the sense that it is a changing amount of money that changes over time. But the parties are free to contract. There's obviously, if I invest in something, if I double my money in a month, that's much better than if I get that exact same amount 5 years from now.
But isn't this different than saying, okay, I want to purchase your right of recovery in the lawsuit. Whatever you recover is my asset. You're not purchasing that. You're purchasing potentially a portion of the recovery, a portion which changes over time.
That's true.
And that doesn't quite look like your regular purchase. It kind of looks like a loan.
And I think that's, to be candid, I think that's why we're here. I think from a superficial standpoint, it looks like that. But if you treat it for what it is a agreement between two parties. There's a meeting of the mind. I know the courts are free to look beyond the terms of a contract to the underlying transaction, but there's a meeting of the minds here that this is a purchase of an asset. Yes, it's a portion of an asset, and that frankly is for the benefit of the consumer. If the purchase is for the entire litigation proceeds, there's no incentive for the consumer to either go forward with their case or settle their case or try and receive compensation for their own harm. So lessening the amount of the purchase to a portion of the proceeds is a benefit for all the parties involved.
Mr. Dunn, let me ask you what may be an unfair question, and I don't mean it to be an unfair question. I'm trying to think, what's the real issue going on here? I mean, I suppose your clients could say, look, we want to be bound, we're okay, we'll be bound by the code. It strikes me as the reason they don't want to be bound by the code is they're concerned about the return that they get, the interest, if you will, which would suggest that's exactly why it should be covered by the code. Could you just address that policy issue? What's your client's concern here, Bill?
Sure. I think first of all, I'll say this: you hit on the exact correct point. It's a policy question. There are fights going on all over the country in legislatures about this issue. How those play out remains to be seen. But that's the proper forum for this issue. We believe universally the case law, almost without exception, if not without exception, supports the argument that non-recourse transactions cannot be loans.
Although part of the problem is most of the cases you cite deal with jurisdictions where they say you do have to have an unconditional obligation to pay to be a loan. Our Supreme Court may be in the minority on that. That strikes me as an issue.
Well, I think that's right. The Supreme Court is in the minority in the sense that they said a conditional obligation can be a loan. There is no court that I know of that has said and been upheld that a non-recourse transaction can be a loan. And I think there's an obvious reason for that. If you deem any transaction, as the state has argued, any advance of money to be a loan, I think one of the glaring omissions from the state's brief is that they actually haven't defined loan. You'd think that'd be the first thing they do, would say a loan is this. And it really doesn't, other than to say it's an advance of money, which surely can't just be an advance of money. That would encompass all kinds of crazy things. So what is it if it encompasses non-recourse transactions? And I don't know the answer to that. So
thank you.
I've got 20 seconds left, so I'll reserve that in case there's something pithy I need to say in rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Dunn.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Paul Chesson, Senior Assistant Attorney General, here on behalf of the appellees, the State of Colorado.
So what is a loan?
A loan is defined, one definition of a loan.
It's not defined in the code?
It is defined in the code. And in fact, CashNow, the CashNow case, relied on that definition. Under the code's plain language, as cited in the CashNow case, the code defines loan to include the lender's creation of debt by the payment of money to the consumer. And CashNow further relied on the code's official comment. And the official comment says a loan is made when a creditor creates debt by advancing money to the consumer. To fulfill its statutory purposes, the code is designed to be simple and it is to be broadly and liberally construed.
How do you define debt?
Debt is not defined per se in the code, but it does define how debt is created. And debt is created, again, by advancing money to the consumer. The purposes of the code, and again, I get the code to be liberally, broadly construed, and is simple. One of the purposes is to simplify and clarify the law. Thus, whenever an advance is made under the code, that is a loan.
If I advance $20 to my daughter, is that a loan?
It very well may be a loan under the code, but it's carved out other places. For example, if it's not a gift,
I was going to say, doesn't an advance suggest that there's an obligation of a return?
An expectation of repayment. If you look at Webster's definition of an advance, I think Webster's defines advance to supply or furnish with an expectation of repayment. And that is also in the Odell v. Legal Bugs case, which dealt with this very kind of transaction, the case out of Kansas, the Decision Point case. Again, they talk about advances. Now, if you look, my colleague says, well, the official comments to the code do not exist. Well, they do. This is the 1999 version of the CRS. If you look at the code, the official comments are there. This is the Uniform Laws Annotated. The official comments are in this book. This book I got next door in the library. They also say that the code was revised in 2000. And this is true. The code was revised in 2000, and at that time, there are actually two model uniform consumer credit codes. There's a 1968 version and there's a 1974 version. The original code that Colorado adopted in 1971 was the 1968 version. In 2000, it created a hybrid. It kept some versions of the 68 code and it adopted some versions of the 74 code. However, this particular definition of loan as the payment of money to the consumer did not change. And in fact, in the official comments to the 1974 code, the official comment says that this definition of loan continues, and I quote, continues the traditional concept of a loan as an advance of money. So yes, the state would argue that all advances of money to consumers are loans. This is a simple definition. It's easily applied, it can be consistently applied, and it provides predictability to lenders, to consumers, to everyone involved.
Go ahead, Judge.
Oh, no, actually, I cut you off before, Judge. No. I apologize.
Mr. Chesson, let me ask you to address really what I think Mr. Dunn was seizing on in CashNow and what causes me some concern. And this kind of goes to this issue of recourse. The Supreme Court, first said you don't have to have an unconditional obligation to repay to be a loan. Fine. It goes on and concludes its big section by saying, as the Ham Court explained, even the lender demonstrates it doesn't view the refund as a chosen action because the borrower owes it a sum of money whether the refunder chose is valuable to the lender or not. This is debt. In that case, I think Mr. Dunn is correct that the lender gets paid either way. That there was a right to go after the taxpayer, even if the taxpayer didn't recover the refund that they were expecting. The Supreme Court seems to say in this second piece of its opinion that that's debt because mm-hmm. it doesn't matter whether there was value or not, the lender is going to get repaid. Mm-hmm. Could you address that? I don't know what to make of that. It strikes me as inconsistent with the first thing the Supreme Court said, or arguably.
Sure, and I would say that the Ham Court itself, and no question the Supreme Court relied on the Ham Court, but the Ham Court itself later on in its opinion said, regardless of the recourse, being able to go after the taxpayer for a deficiency, even if that provision did not exist, this would still be a loan. So that's what the Ham Court said. And elsewhere in the Cash Now case, quoting from where it discussed the Court of Appeals' reliance on the Cullen v. Bragg case out of South Carolina, it said that the definition of loan under the UCCC does not require repayment. Nowhere in the code is there any requirement of recourse. And in fact, in certain circumstances, the code prohibits the lender, the creditor, from going after the consumer for a deficiency. Therefore, under certain circumstances, it requires that certain transactions be non-recourse. And in fact, if recourse were required for a loan, then as the US Supreme Court said over 200 years ago, only a bungler would structure its transactions to include that requirement. And there are other cases that we've cited in our brief, the case out of New York, the Hall versus Eagle Insurance Company. Again, there was no recourse required. Non-recourse loans, I would disagree with my colleague, non-recourse loans are common. The pawn is a classic and very humble type of transaction, which is non-recourse. The pawnbroker can only look at the pawned item for its repayment. If the pawned item is worthless, for example, I pawn a Rolex watch, but it turns out to be a knockoff, the pawnbroker is left holding the knockoff and cannot go after the consumer for any deficiency.
But nonetheless, we do have all sorts of opportunities for recourse here.
That's correct. But I would say that
I understand your point is yes. That it's not required, but nonetheless, that exists here.
That's true. There are many opportunities for Oasis and Lawcash to go after their borrowers. But again, I suppose that we're looking for a broader application because, again, it would be an easy circumvention, an easy way around the law to if a lender were simply to structure their loan and make it non-recourse. And we don't think the code is that easily circumvented.
But I suppose it's just definitional, Mr. Chesson. I understand you don't think recourse is required, but how do you understand that term?
We define recourse in the brief. I think we use a treatise as well as a U.S. Supreme Court case, basically where the lender is looking at a particular asset that is the lender has a particular collateral security and that is looking solely to that asset, cannot look at any other of the borrower's assets. And a very common definition of non-recourse, this is out of Black's Law Dictionary, is a secured loan that allows the lender to attach only the collateral, not the borrower's personal assets. So that's basically what non-recourse is. And like I said, a pawn is a very common form of non-recourse loan. So that's what we're talking about, recourse. Here, of course, as Judge Bernard, as you observed, the lenders here do have opportunities to go after the borrower's other assets in a number of different circumstances and events of default. And indeed, even Oasis's contract provides for liquidated damages of twice the amount that is owed under the contract for specific types of defaults.
Specific types of defaults, but those defaults are unrelated, aren't they, to the obligation to repay? In other words, what I'm saying is that they do not come into play if the recovery in the lawsuit is less than OASIS anticipated.
Well,
they don't make up a deficiency through those other remedies.
I think their contracts are less than models of clarity in that regard. While it is true that in the contracts there is language that says that if the proceeds are insufficient, I think OASIS defines the term as the ownership amount, which is what the full amount should be due and owed. There is a provision in the contract that says if the proceeds are less than the full amount that we're owed, we will get all of the proceeds. But then there are other provisions that seem to contradict that and say that we can get for our costs of collection include our ownership amount. So I think there's some inconsistencies. Like I say, I don't think they're all that clear.
Are they inconsistent when you say the cost of collection, what we would be otherwise due under the contract?
And how
does that, add any particular rights? If the seller were to obtain the judgment that they expected, mm-hmm. and did not turn their money over, mm-hmm. to OASIS, are mm-hmm. you saying OASIS should not have an opportunity to recover what was the seller was obliged to do under the contract?
I'm not saying that at all. But what I am saying is that it's not necessary for it to be a loan. And in fact,
aren't those other remedies though really irrelevant to determining whether the transaction is a loan?
I think we're saying that, if I heard you correctly, I think we're saying the same thing, that their rights to pursue the borrower to collect their ownership amount under a number of different circumstances, that's not necessary for it to be a loan. It's still non-recourse.
Or even perhaps a sale. It's not necessary for it to be a sale, those other types of remedies.
Well, under the code, consumers are not in the business of selling their accounts receivable. The word came out, factor. Consumers don't factor their accounts receivable to meet their cash flow needs. Consumers get loans, and that's under the code. So we can't look what might happen in the commercial arena, in the commercial context, and freely translate that to the code. Again, the code is designed to protect consumers. And one of the other statutory purposes is to protect consumers from the unfair practices of some suppliers of credit.
And you use the term consumers, they use the term seller. And how do we determine which is which?
Well, again, are they advancing money? If they are advancing money, then that is a loan. So then we are within the construct of the code. You're sort of asking a chicken and an egg kind of question. At least I think so. But I would say that looking at the gist of this transaction, they're advancing money, they're getting more money later, they're looking to a particular asset for that repayment, and that's perfectly fine under the code. That is a classic non-recourse secured loan.
I'm a little concerned. Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Chesson, I didn't mean to interrupt you. I guess you keep talking about advancing money. That's not a loan, A-L-O-N-E, a loan enough here. I mean, the definition of loan is creation of debt by the payment of money. So you have to have both, not just an advance of money. It has to be an advance of money that creates a debt.
Well, let's look at a classic definition of debt. Again, Blacks defines debt as a liability on a claim or an amount due. Here there is an amount due, not personally from the borrower, but there is an amount due from the proceeds of the lawsuit.
And that's the point. You keep talking about just advancing money. It strikes me it has to be advancing money to create an obligation back.
And there is an obligation here.
Okay, but that's correct, right? I mean, there has to be that obligation too.
Well, the official comment to the code doesn't say that. It says that the 74 official comment says that this continues the traditional concept of a loan as an advance.
Sure, but the problem with that is that it ignores the word debt in the statute. The comment could say what it wants, but we have to deal with the word debt.
And I would agree that there is a something owed. It's not a gift.
I thought you had earlier said a debt is an advance with the expectation of repayment.
Yeah. Well, that's again the same concept of something owed. These aren't gifts.
Yeah, that's what I was trying to come back to, because we seemed to. I was concerned you had changed your position.
And again, if we focus just on the individual case where someone may not recover anything and there may not be any repayment, that's Mr. Dunn's argument. But as a practical matter, if that happened a lot, these things wouldn't be happening, because people, you know, the people advancing the money wouldn't be getting repaid. So don't we have to look at this as an industry as opposed to an individual case?
Well, I think your point is well taken, that in fact they do extensive underwriting. I think the literature says that Oasis turns away 70% of the transactions that it might be applied for. LawCash, the literature quotes LawCash as saying they only have a 4% loss history. Credit card banks would do wonders if they had a 4% rate of loss. So yes, they are in business to make. They are, of course, in business to make money. These aren't speculative transactions. They do extensive underwriting and vetting to make sure that when they loan their money out, they're going to get repaid.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Before you begin, Mr. Dunn, would
you set the clock at 1 minute and 10 seconds, please? I know you had 20 seconds, but. We'll give you the benefit of about the same time as Mr. Chesson had.
I appreciate that. Mr. Chesson says that an advance...
Hold one second. Perfect. Go ahead.
Mr. Chesson said that a loan is an advance, and an advance is a transaction with an expectation of repayment. I would encourage the court to read the Odell versus LegalBucks case that they actually rely on, because in that case, the statute at issue has two separate types of transactions. They have loans and they have advances. And the court actually says in that transaction, in that case, which is identical, virtually identical to the case here, the court said that's not a loan, but it is an advance. And they have a separate definition of advance in that state, in North Carolina, which is, as Mr. Chesson said, has an expectation of repayment.
But Odell said that it was an advance because there was no unconditional obligation to repay. That's the holding in Odell. And the problem is the definition of loan is different, I think.
Definitely, I think they use it's not a UCCC state, so they use a usury definition of loan, which does require an unconditional obligation of repayment, but that was not central to the case. What they said was, is there something less here than a contingent obligation? There may be a mere expectation that the purchaser will get their money back, will get their money through the litigation proceeds. But that is not a loan. That is maybe just a mere expectation. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you both, counsel, for your excellent arguments in this case. Case will stand submitted, and opinion will issue in due course.